manual. We did it ourselves.
We're going to sound like butter.
We are going to sound like butter. Yeah.
Watch, we're going to get a text from email later. Actually, said he has to work from the Zoom audio or something. He's like, actually, I just worked from the wire I put on you guys before you came. We're definitely in person. Or you can save the part about how proud you are about that. You can even chime in to add that.
You can let the listener know how proud you are.
Exactly.
Yes, yes. I'm real proud of you guys. Good job.
The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, featuring your hosts, Gabe Reinick and Ken Holyoke.
Welcome back to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. I'm Gabe Reinick in Fredericton, New Brunswick, and we have a rare treat for you today. I am joined by Ken Holyoke, who's not only in Fredericton, New Brunswick, he's in the same room that I am.
Yes, this is we're experiencing a studio environment here. There's baffling, like real baffling.
Oh yeah,
this is not just Ken putting up blankets around his Studio 598. This is
the Thrill on the Hill studio, I think.
The Thrill on the Hill,
or the Thrill in the Hill.
Yes,
Thrill in the Hill.
We're kind of built into the hill.
Yes, we're built into the hill.
Yeah,
which is to say, we are at an undisclosed bunker in a built into a mountainside that definitely can't be blown up.
Yeah,
and so Ken, what brings you out here?
Well, I'm out here doing field work. Well, actually, I'm done my field work.
You're done.
I'm recording this podcast right now, and then I head back to Lethbridge tomorrow.
Oh, wow. Okay. Excellent. And you think you do?
I think I do,
You would try to,
In fact, actually, so on the nearly 2.5-year anniversary of a, well, I guess just about 2 years, to a massive flight delay that I had one of the times I was coming out here.
Right.
WestJet, thanks to our passenger rights protections, the federal government, WestJet had to pay up. As I suspected they had to all along.
Yes.
But they just made it last for, just made me wait for a while.
So there was not just a passenger right, but it sounds like a passenger was wrong. Is what you're telling me.
I was wronged.
Excellent. And so we won't spoil the fun too much for the listener, but we're each going to be discussing our field work through a series of interviews today on the podcast, which we're pretty excited about. But Ken, what have you been getting up to out here in Fredericton? Have you done anything fun? Gone to any restaurants you particularly like?
Yeah, actually. So there's been a bunch of stuff open really since I kind of like was last on the restaurant scene in New Brunswick. And so let's see. The Momo, the new noodle house downtown, is quite good on the corner of Queen and Westmoreland.
We had a nice lunch at El Mariachi.
Yes.
As well,
yeah, that was definitely a highlight. The get the queso birria taco. It is a queso birria one. It is a treat.
Yes, they do quite a nice margarita there too.
Very good margarita. Yep. I'm trying to think. There was somewhere else that I ate that was quite good. Got some wings from PJ's.
I've actually never been there, but I've heard it's quite good.
Yeah, the very good fish and chips, but also excellent wings.
Okay, all right. Yeah. Well, you heard it here first, listener. That's where to go. And so, Ken, one of the things that the listener might notice is, this is one of those things where the exception kind of proves the rule, that we are both in New Brunswick right now.
Yes.
And this podcast is still named the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, is it not?
It is. It is.
And so one of the interesting things I think about that is that even after, 2 years now of this? A year and change of this?
Three, isn't it?
Is it 3 years?
I think so, because we're in our third season.
Oh. Time flies when you're having fun, Ken. And so, you know, but I mean, the award-winning New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast is about so much more than New Brunswick Archaeology, is it not?
It is. Our reach extends far beyond the borders of this lovely province.
That's so true. And so one of the things that we've considered doing is that maybe we should get a new name for this podcast.
That's right. We have had this open, ongoing, running contest.
Mm-hmm.
And although we have had many great suggestions over the last couple of years, there isn't one that has just kind of hit the nail on the head yet.
That's right, Ken. But I think we've got the right one, Ken, for the listener who sends in with a new name for this podcast that we think captures the essence of it. And so, Ken, you just finished supervising a couple of weeks of field research with a decent-sized crew, and I'm sure your experience matched mine. Days devoted purely to the task at hand. Dig kits each with the correct number of line levels, everyone respecting your out-of-office reply, relaxing evenings, sipping Courvoisier, and admiring how carefully organized everyone's notes were, relaxing the certainty, the absolute certainty that everyone, everyone's gas and lodging receipts are perfectly organized and just waiting to be submitted for reimbursement. Is that right, Ken?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I have no receipts that were just sitting in the dashboard of my vehicle and have lost all of the ink.
Yes. No, no. Of course not. And so, Ken, the listener who's done any fieldwork knows that fieldwork is a disaster, both physically and emotionally. It offers a rare opportunity for an archaeologist to let the desk part of his life spiral out of control while also losing all sense of time and place in the field, to say nothing of the paperwork disasters that fieldwork invariably incepts. In fact, Ken, studies have shown that after 4 weeks in the field, the typical archaeologist's Outlook calendar becomes completely unusable. And after 6 weeks, it actually begins to metastasize and start changing the publication dates on papers in their EndNote libraries.
Yep.
And Ken, for the lucky listener who renames this podcast, we have some great news. Despite a recent slew of literature saying archaeologists were going to be in overwhelmingly high demand, both poles of political life in North America have finally agreed that what was really holding each of our nations back from human flourishing, a chicken or a vegan chicken substitute in every pot and a four-day work week, were pesky laws surrounding amorphous concepts like the environment and Marx's Lenin-Luxemburgist plots like zoning. But Ken, just like every rose has its thorn, every cloud has its silver lining, and in this case it's thousands, yes, thousands of unemployed field technicians. And Ken, Mad Max Fury Road style, we've got a great plan to not only use them as blood bags for the few remaining employed archaeologists, but also to send them to server farms at secret undisclosed locations where they can function as virtual assistants in a mostly Hold on. Okay, I'm hearing our producer remind us that the Morton Joe Prize needs to go through additional review. Okay. So what are we going to do here? Ken, give me just a second while I flip through the notes here.
Okay. Yep.
Okay. All right, this is what I mean, Ken. See, I was in the field, and I didn't even notice that legal had let us know that we had to put the kibosh on the blood bag administrative assistant plan. But just bear with me, listener. Okay, Emmanuel, let's scratch that last bit. And Emmanuel, if you could insert some cheerful music here, that would be good. Yeah, think like when you're watching TV late at night and you see an advertisement for a drug. Okay. See, Ken, and that's the level of disorganization that fieldwork invariably causes, and that's exactly where AI comes in. That's right, Ken. What we actually have for the listener who renames this podcast is something called TrialGPT. TrialGPT loads onto your phone and is capable of completing 94% of the administrative tasks a field archaeologist confronts with 48% accuracy. Needed to submit your expense claims? TrialGPT is on it. About to put the form for shovel test pits number 8 through 12 in the wrong folder where it will never be seen again? TrialGPT will politely ask you if you'd like to instead put it in the correct folder so you can misplace all the SDP forms at once for the sake of efficiency. Need to make a schedule of field dates that will be totally obliterated by thunderstorms and entirely rebuilt? TrialGPT. And how does it accomplish all this, Ken? Large language learning models. That's right, Ken. TrialGPT is sort of like a parrot. We had it around some of the best archaeological projects in the world, learning what words archaeologists like to string together. So in addition to being able to swear and make dirty jokes in more than 20 languages, TrialGPT has learned to predict those little friction points that make the minutes feel like hours and the post-excavation process violate the Geneva Convention. And that's not all, Ken. You and the listener may remember Number One Noodle in Saskatoon. Does anything stick out in your mind about Number One Noodle, Ken?
Well, they had robotic serving assistants.
That's right. They had a robotic waiter. And well, Ken, we've empowered TrialGPT with a fully armored and off-road Pudu Bellabot robotic waiter named Schliemann, who we've also equipped with a Mossberg Pro 940 12 gauge. That's 14 metric gauges, shotgun for bear defense. Misplaced your pencil again? Schliemann's off to the truck to fetch it for you. Forgot to put on some sunblock? Schliemann is there, lathering you in SPF 50. And it's really amazing how thoughtful, even gentle, he is. About to backfill an SDP while the truck keys are in it? That bear gun will hit you in your ribs while Schliemann tells you to get your act together. And Ken, I think it goes without saying that Schliemann appreciates when the crew works quickly. Very quickly. And he knows how to enforce that. That's right, Ken. With TrialGPT and Schliemann on the job, you may find yourself wondering, do we even need human archaeologists at all? It's just that easy. And so, Ken, where would the lucky listener looking to maximize efficiency and shake off the chains of administrative hassles at the end of the season send their entry?
From Hisarlik at Troy to your hearts, ladies and gentlemen, that would be newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word, archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com.
That's right. And Ken, if you look into that mailbag, what is in that mailbag today?
We do have a mail. We've got a couple items in the mailbag.
Lovely.
So, Dimity writes Touching Base.
Oh, good evening to me. We haven't heard from Divinity in a little while.
Yeah. So, hi guys. Just checking in to say how much I'm enjoying the podcast. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Divinity. We appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, I used to listen at night when Emmanuel's techno dance music would wake me up. For some reason, it annoyed my spouse when I couldn't resist tapping to the music. I love the music, by the way. Well, there you go.
Oh, lovely.
This is, Emmanuel, this is your first listener mail as well. So you should be, that's excellent. Anyway.
We should plug who the music is by here. It's by Justin Hanke and...
Shane Dahl.
Yes.
So, but the remember Emmanuel did the
yes, he
his
did
his original composition and,
for New Year's, I believe.
Yeah, yes. Or the hits, the what to listen to for 2025. Yes. So
was it five hits, six hits?
I think so. Yeah, hits. Yeah. We figured that was the most that fair use policy would fair dealing or whatever it is.
Yes, we had to consult with a librarian to make sure it was all okay.
Exactly. So Dimity continues. Anyway, it seems that the podcasts are almost always in places where I've spent time.
Oh, and cool.
NB, of course, but also the Saco area or Saco. Where I spent many summers at Ferry Beach.
Oh, cool.
The highlight of the summer was going to Old Orchard Beach Amusement Park. We all love the rides. I imagine it's gone now. Is it?
No. Still there, I believe.
There it is. Yeah. There you go. It was a favorite vacation spot for Quebecers. Your last
still is. Yes.
Your last pod was terrific. The PEI stuff was most interesting, and I love that Helen found so much joy in finding unexpected history like from the Highlanders and the Quakers. As an old-timer, it is very interesting, though, not surprising, to hear about the growth in CRM compared with research archaeology. The spot on an earlier pod referencing Chris's paper on the potential of CRM growth and some of the pitfalls that it could incur was prescient. It was all very new in my time, and although now and then I did some surveys, etc., it was not my thing. Archaeological work here in hot and crispy Arizona is at a standstill. I had hoped to open our 1752 site in the winter, but I became president of our historical society and took me a bit of a time to change from all about art to all about history. It is now back to what it should be with a great library and research room and a vibrant group of researchers meeting every Wednesday to dig down to find the bones of this old town digitally, of course.
Lovely. My recollection is this is the Tubac Historical Society, right?
Yes, I think that is correct. Keep up the good work, guys. Gabe, I can't wait to hear what you were doing at the Saco site. And Ken, what is happening with you in lovely NB? Well, Dimity, this is a very timely email because you're going to get to hear all about what we were doing, basically.
This is indeed.
And we'll Gabe and I will talk about a little bit about here, but we're also going to talk to some of the folks from our crew about what we were doing. And so you get to hear some of the voices of the people who we were working with this summer.
We sure are. And thanks for writing in, Dimity.
Yeah, thank you. We also have another one here.
Excellent.
And the title of this one says, Interesting Articles Regarding Pleistocene Megafaunal Extinctions. And it starts, Gabe and Ken, I want to thank you again for hosting and developing the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast. I say again, in quotes, because I had emailed you previously regarding the social media site Blue Sky. You speculated that possibly I was some AI-generated bot.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
To which my family and I got a good laugh.
Oh,
and
no.
So this is from Patrick, who had emailed us a while ago, and we couldn't figure out whether it was like... And so, Patrick.
Sorry, Patrick. This might say more about our understanding of the internet than it does about you. I apologize.
Yeah. So, to which my family and I got a good laugh. I have thoroughly enjoyed MBAP programs. They're both informative and entertaining. Well, thank you, Patrick.
Thank you, Patrick.
This communication revolves.
Patrick, who listener, is definitely not a robot.
Is definitely not a robot or has become more advanced.
Yes, that's true.
It's become sentient.
Yes. He's hanging out with Schliemann.
Yeah. This communication revolves around your hit pieces segment in season 3, episode 17, regarding the overkill hypothesis. Mm-hmm. I've attached two articles that discuss recent archaeological research that lends support for overkill. Not to exclude environmental factors, but the research is pointing into the directions of Homo sapiens' involvement in Pleistocene megafaunal extinctions. Note, all articles are from Science, and no, I am not the editorial staff of Science, nor do I have any financial connections to Science.
Does he run their Blue Sky?
I am a member of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the magazine comes with a membership.
Lovely.
Briefly, the first article is a study of South American sloths using trait modeling, which combines, quote, total evidence, evolutionary trees, and comprehensive size data set, unquote, to analyze sloth morphological characteristics temporally as they relate to paleoclimatic changes. The author's conclusion was that the rapid extinction of large ground sloth populations cannot be explained through climate change alone, and instead suggests human-driven factors as a major contributing factor. That's very interesting.
Okay.
The second study out of Australia focuses on kangaroo resilience to quaternary climatic condition variations, showing that kangaroos' ability to utilize mixed feeding enables them to be more resilient to climatic variations affecting food supplies. The author's conclusion is that the extinction of large body kangaroos is mostly consistent with human predation pressure sometime around 40,000 years ago. And for those of you that don't know, these Pleistocene kangaroos in Australia can get up to like 2.5 meters high or
something
like that. They're like... There's this great article.
Like, you could live in their pouch.
Yeah. And, like, and you know, you think you hear about these kangaroos attacking people or getting in scraps with people. These would be, like, you're done. One punch.
Yeah.
Toast. Interesting reading. The kangaroo study used dental microwave texture analysis, or DMTA. I think you've had some of that before at clubs, right?
Yes.
I wonder if the same technique could be used to study large fauna Pleistocene extinction in the United States and Canada. As an added bonus, I have also included an article on synthetic aperture sonar, a rapidly evolving technology that can be used to map ocean floor seafloor features in centimeter resolution. What a tool this would be to assist in cataloging off-coast or near-coast cultural resources that have been lost under increasing sea level rises. Possibly a future graduate student research project? I think that's an excellent idea. All food for thought. Keep up the good work. And again, thank you for producing archaeological programming that is both interesting and comprehensible. Cheers. Patrick in Longmeadow, Meadow, Massachusetts.
So no kidding. Thank you so much, Patrick.
Thank you very much, Patrick. And
Apologies again for the earlier misunderstanding. Ken, would you maybe do we want to drop those in the show notes or just read out the citations for the papers that Patrick sent?
We should put them in the show notes,
great.
But also we'll read them out. And so the first article is The Emergence and Demise of Giant Sloths by Alberto Boscani and a group of authors, so et al. And that is in the May 2025 issue of Science, pages 864 to 868. The next one is called Dietary Breadth in Kangaroos Facilitated Resilience to Quaternary Climatic Variations by Samuel D. Armand, Grant A. Gully, and Gavin J. Perdue. And that is in Science, January 2025, volume 387, issue 6730, pages 167 to 170. And then the last article is Sonar Tool Poised to Map Seafloor in Fine Detail, by Rachel Berkowitz, and it's from the May 2025 issue of Science, and it's in the news section, pages 806 to 807.
Fantastic. Thank you, Patrick.
Yeah, so we got hit pieces and an email.
There we go.
That's a combo pack that we love, Patrick. You're doing our work for us. So
yes.
You should write back with some more detailed information, and we can send you some stickers. I think we're both due for a re-up on the batch of stickers, so maybe you'll get a gold one.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
I think we need some new gold stickers.
But yes, Patrick, please do email us your mailing address,
and
we'll have Schliemann get that to you.
Yes.
Yeah. Excellent. Ken, so, Ken, I think we are, and if the listener wants to write in, where do they send emails?
They're going to send that to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's newbrunswickarchaeology, all one word, archaeology spelled archaeology, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com.
That's right. We love listening from you. We love hearing from you. Yes.
And so, Gabe,
how's the end of your field season going?
Yeah, I was just going to say, Gabe, how is it? Yeah.
So I think what we were going to try to do here, Ken, was to let the list. We each have, I believe, a collection of perhaps somewhat disjointed interviews from the field. So we need to set a little context for what those are about.
I have less of a collection and sort of a one group of interviews with a collection of individuals that were in the field with me.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I didn't successfully get anything outdoors because as you and I were talking about, it is this might not be something we do next year.
Yes.
Which is attempt to record two separate episodes from the field.
Yes.
So that's the idea, is that we're you're going to hear from people on each of our field programs. Gabe was in doing the, I believe it's called the Northeast Archaeological Field School.
Yeah, well, so the projects, the program, I guess, the research group is the Northeastern Archaeological Survey, which is an homage to the original Northeastern Archaeological Survey, which was a project headed by Ted Stoddard in the 1950s.
Right.
And that's what we've in honor of that, we've adopted that name for our field program.
Yes, with some excellent badges that were made by Wally.
Yes, that's right. Wally made the patches, which we should redo. We should plant another order for the patches. Honestly.
Yeah. I would love to get one for a backpack or something.
Oh,
like
do you not even have one?
No, I don't have one.
Oh,
no.
I apologize. Okay. Yeah.
Actually, you know what? Maybe I do. I have a sticker maybe. There's something outside my lab, I think, that I might have just stuck it onto the poster board at my lab.
Okay, well, we should find you a patch.
Yeah.
But no, those are excellent. And so what we were doing this season with the field school was we had a small field school, about six students, and the first half of it or so was at Kennebunk Plains in southern Maine.
Yep.
And Kennebunk Plains is a sandy, stabilized dune landscape of just the variety that Paleo-Indians like very much. And so
Paleo-Indians and airports.
Paleo-Indians and airports. Love it.
Yeah.
Exactly. Also, pretty great to screen.
Yes, like a sandbox.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And it's also the home of the Hedden Paleo-Indian site, reported by the Maine Historic Preservation Commission. Tim Spahr recently had identified a flake at a different locus. We went back and we tested it. And naturally, we failed to locate any additional Paleo-Indian deposits. But in one shovel test bit, we did find about eight or nine flakes.
Nice.
And we have no reason to think those are Paleo-Indian.
Oh, okay.
Not only that, but in classic, this is, I felt very good about my testing strategy here. Dawson Burnett and I were laying in. We wanted to tighten the testing strategy because Paleo-Indian sites often reward a fairly tight testing strategy.
Yeah, yeah. And they're very low density deposits and yeah.
Yes. And so we were tightening up testing, and for some reason I managed to pull off, I guess, the wrong points and put in a test pit not really on the grid. That is, of course, where the flakes were.
Oh, good.
Yeah,
okay.
So that's what we call judgmental testing.
Yes, yeah. But you meant to do that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It
shows the students that, like, you can sort of prospect just out of your, you know, shoot from the hip kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you see these suckers testing on a grid, and I just think, what are you doing? And then the second half of the season, where we had sort of a ringer site to get the students' experience using material that from more recent time periods, you know, including ceramics and lithics, we were back to the University of New England site, which is known for being the place where Champlain first landed, and it's also a middle woodland on habitation right there at the University of New England campus. So that was the second half of the project.
Yep, and we've talked about it with Arthur.
We have.
So I think if you go back to season two, there's an episode called Champlain Problems that you guys are talking about that site.
I think there is, and that's a T-Swift reference.
A T-Swift reference, yes.
Excellent.
It helps the SEO.
Yes. Ms. Swift, if you're listening and would like to sponsor this podcast, you just let us know. And so that's what we were doing. And what were you doing, Ken?
So this is the my project is the Lower Wollastoog Erosion Project. And so basically what we're looking at is much the same as your research has focused sort of centrally around identifying and coming up with sort of strategies to deal with coastal erosion. In the interior regions of New Brunswick and other places are also experiencing erosion, threatening archaeological sites, and some of this is a natural process, but some of this has also been exacerbated, particularly in places like the Lower Wollastoog, by increased storm intensity and frequency, sort of the amplitude of the spring freshet, that kind of thing, so the annual floods. And so for a number of years, I was doing work around the quarry for Washtenaw Lake. Noticed there that there's a lot of stuff coming out of the banks and shorelines. So over the last couple of years, I've been developing this project where working with Wollastoogwe Nation and partners with Mi'kmaq communities to basically come up with some strategies for identifying sites, recording them, and probably implementing some kind of mitigative strategy. So whether it's excavation or coming up with these sorts of solutions with the long-term goal of communities kind of leading their own heritage management in the future, right? And so archaeologists being involved, but Wollastoogwe making decisions about Wollastoogwe history, basically. So this year was the second year of the program. We went out and did some survey last August, very limited in scope. The goals this year were to continue to work some work at two places, Fulton Island and Ekbahog Island, both of which are basically, you know, the whole islands mm-hmm. are archaeological sites.
And maybe we should put the Fulton Island thesis from years ago in the show notes.
Yeah, yeah. Ellen Folks' thesis from 1981 would be a good starting point for that. There's not a whole lot published on Ekbahog. There's a couple of technical reports. The site's been visited kind of off and on. But both are significant locations for indigenous groups, but also Ekbahog is historically very important for Wollastoogwe. It was the location of an 18th century village and some very other interesting things. And so Some of this work is survey work, so identifying eroding resources along the banks. And then at Fulton Island, we opened up an excavation targeted at trying to identify an in-situ late maritime woodland component or post-contact component. And so the crew that was out with me this year were a group of students who you'll hear from today. So Dallas, Becca, Kira, Aurora, who are all working with Ramona Nicholas, who's the co-director on this project with me, as well as some other community members and some engagement sessions and that kind of thing. And so and with some help from a former graduate student of yours, Josh Cummings, mm-hmm. came out and it's been fantastic to work with. So the goals of the project were very kind of focused this year on getting everybody on board with some of the excavation work and also teaching skills. So although it wasn't a field school specifically aimed at doing a field school, we were really kind of took our time to make sure everybody kind of got into the swing of things, working with excavation and, you know, teaching them how to put in a one by one. And the crew was very, very good at doing that. I was very impressed by that. And doing some detailed mapping and things and really kind of making the plan for the next couple of years for what this program will look like. And it'll probably be more work at excavation work at Fulton Island and probably getting toward doing some other like non-invasive work at Ekbahog and potentially some testing in an area where we found a site last year.
That's fantastic. And in addition to that, Ken, we did some work on a project we're collaborating on.
Yeah.
We had a bit of Bailey activity.
Yeah, yeah. So we did our first, so kind of did a combo pack community meeting where we at Zidansisk, we hosted a community archaeology day, basically. Part of that was focused on the Bailey work, and we're continuing the cataloging work with that. And I guess, have we done like an episode on the Bailey project?
I was just trying to remember. So the listener, we have a paper coming out on late Paleo-Indian in New Brunswick.
Yes, which we'll devote an episode to.
Yeah, and that is the first publication arising from the Bailey project. You know, Ken, I don't know if we've done the Bailey in great detail.
Yeah, so to give you guys some background on it, and maybe we'll make the late Paleo episode some backgrounder and get some, you know, other voices in on that
as
well.
And the longtime listener will know that the promises Ken and I make in these introductory segments are not legally binding. we may parse this in any number of ways.
So, exactly. Yeah. Much the same as how we always promise stickers. Eventually they will come.
They will.
It's just they won't come in the time frame that we promise they will.
Very likely, yes.
But the Bailey project was a couple years ago when we were working on the bibliography project. Trevor Dow was looking to take some photographs of some artifacts. And we knew about a small collection that was held at UNB's Archives and Special Collections of Indigenous artifacts. And so Trevor went up there one day, and then we got sort of a bunch of text messages from him in quick succession with some pictures of some incredibly unique and rare and significant artifacts from New Brunswick's Indigenous history. And realized immediately that some of this stuff was likely from probably burials, probably late maritime archaic Moorhead phase burials. And so we felt it was prudent to reach out to descendant communities. And so we've been engaged with Wolastoqiyik Nation on this project really from the get-go. Through that process have basically spent the last couple of years working through doing a detailed inventory of the collection, so descriptions and measurements. And are starting to peel off pieces to start kind of sharing and disseminating about the collection itself and probably a lot of other kind of fun things over the next couple mm-hmm. of years too.
Yeah. And one of the sort of roots of our I think, surprise about it was we sort of hadn't realized, even though we could have realized if we'd done enough background work on it, that the collection had not been entirely reported on, which there's an undergraduate paper by David Sanger, I believe, actually, about the collection. And we had just sort of thought, oh, that's it. And then Trevor started realizing that there were lots of boxes with the kinds of things you outlined and that we really needed to switch this over to be a collaborative project.
Yeah, yeah. So it went from being, I think, what we thought was around 25 artifacts to about 25 boxes of artifacts. And so there's
a classic mixed blessing in the archaeological world, listener.
Yeah, it was. And so, I mean, and it's really fascinating. And, you know, we talk a lot about context on here. And so some of this stuff is difficult to place specifically where it came from, but we've got a pretty good sense from Bailey's notes, some of the stories about Bailey, but also like on some of the stuff is written right on the artifacts. Much of the collection comes from the Lower Wolastoq, particularly in around the Mequapit Lake area, where there's some fairly significant sites, a couple of which definitely date to the late Maritime Archaic or have components related to it. But there's also some really other interesting stuff. Like there's some artwork. There's a mobiliary art, a sculpture of a groundstone frog, which is totally unique.
Mm-hmm. That will be going on the Bailey T-shirts if you're going to be okay with it. Will be the plan.
Yeah, and then there's this this beautiful pink-colored translucent glass bead that appears to, based on some feedback we got from a glass or a bead specialist at the Smithsonian, that it's likely from sometime in the early 19th century in Bohemia. How it ended up
being
in
Bohemians ourselves, Ken and I were very, very glad to see this.
And this is not one of the small trade beads. This is like it's a very large bead that probably, I guess, would have been part of a clasp or a necklace or something like that. But but there's a bunch of stuff in that collection. Like there's a groundstone tool that's probably about 30 pounds and about the size of my torso.
Yes.
And so there's a number of items in that collection that are sort of one. And even without really good stratigraphic context or any stratigraphic context or really knowing where they're from, being able to talk about them in the context of like New Brunswick archaeology, I think is really important.
Yeah. And just to be clear, Ken and I saying that the pounds, that the size of our torso is 30 pounds is a segue to our next advertiser, which is Ozempic.
Yeah, the torso is definitely not on the slimmer side coming out of field work. This is the challenge, right, Gabe, is that the field season now is not me stomping on a shovel and getting a workout every day. It is like writing notes and watching people doing some work and kind of just panicking about what we're going to do next.
Yes.
And then eating and drinking in the evening.
Yes, working this close to town is a serious liability in the field season.
Exactly.
Yeah. Excellent. And so, so those are kind of the three projects, I guess, that we've been working on out here. And, I think, Ken, maybe we'll hand it over to the interviews, and we hope that this introduction kind of helps you organize it. And I wanted to add, though, also, it's been fun. Any field season, I think it's fun to run into and chat with a bunch of people you don't see as much in your kind of, office life. And so it was good to run into folks we saw in Maine. It's one of those, like, if I were to name you all, I'd be excluding too many people. So great to see you all. And I'd also like to thank the students and all the folks we worked with and collaborated with on these projects.
Yeah. So Waliwan, and thanks to the crew that I had out with me. And same thing. It was really great. Got to hang out with people that I haven't seen for a long time. So friends inside and out of archaeology and thanks to UNB for putting me up while I was here. That was also very nice that I got some lab space here that on campus. And this has been a lot of fun and the first of many years, I think, on this project.
Excellent. All right, listener. Well, we will endeavor to get a little bit back on schedule, but really no promises until the school year kicks off. But we do have some interviews coming up, and so we're gonna aim for that roughly fortnightly schedule, but maybe a little bit off kilter.
I think roughly fortnightly might be even generous.
It
could be. It could be. I think a fortnight and a half is a reasonable.
Precisely.
Yeah. So that's kind of how I feel right now.
Yes.
Like a fortnight and a half.
Yes. All right, listener. We will talk to you soon.
All right, there. Would you like to describe the scene?
We are shoveling the spoil heap back into a brigade of carefully labeled scientific buckets and getting it all back in the ground.
Okay, why are we putting it all back in the ground?
Because we're done excavating.
Okay, and are you ever really done excavating?
No.
Okay.
That's what the tarp's for.
We're done excavating for now.
We're done excavating.
Okay, and Dawson, would you like to describe your technique here?
I'm kind of haphazardly throwing dirt around into the buckets, depending on which label I like the best.
Oh, fantastic. What's your favorite label so far?
There's the one about Bruce Coburn.
Oh, yeah? And what does that say?
It says this bucket would rather be listening to Bruce Coburn's seminal album. What is it called?
I believe we picked the one that was called Night Vision.
Night Vision.
Yeah.
I hear it was Al's favorite.
Yeah, I think that's Al Hanzinger's favorite. And
oh, there it is right there.
Oh, yeah. Can we get...
I'm going to try.
We're going to get a sing of the shovel here while Dawson fills that up.
Archaeology is such an audio medium.
It is, really. Yes.
I'm going to...
Oh, yeah, that's...
Actually, the sound of accidentally shoveling it into two buckets and knocking them over is even better.
That's pretty incredible. Yes. And Taylor, are you finding this to be a helpful pedagogical exercise right now?
What's the question? I'm so sorry.
Oh, yeah, are you finding this to be a helpful pedagogical exercise right
Absolutely.
Now?
Absolutely.
Good. That's what I thought. Matt, would you like to come over here for a quick interview?
I'd love to.
Excellent. I can follow you while you move buckets full of dirt if you'd like.
Absolutely.
Okay. The So I'm joined here by Matt Smith.
Hello, hello.
UNB.
Yes, sir.
What year are you?
Technically second.
Fantastic.
But first year arts.
Excellent. And what causes you to be outstanding in this field?
Well, you know, I had a great professor in my fall semester. Uh-huh. He definitely let
me
know.
It was Nicole Hughes, wasn't it?
No, Mr. Martin Hranek. So I have.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Gabe is blushing heavily behind his
chair. Yes. Okay. Well, I appreciate that. And but you're interested in maritime archaeology.
Yes, absolutely. Trying to get in touch with Nathaniel King.
Okay, excellent. So you thought archaeology by the coast would be similar.
Yes, absolutely. Excellent.
Okay, so we'll get you in the water next time.
Oh, for sure.
All right. What was the highlight for field school for you this year?
Honestly. Mostly just getting a really good experience of infield experience.
Okay. You mostly had outfield experience before that.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Mostly that and really just getting to find some of those significant flakes.
Fantastic. Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm glad.
Sweet.
All right. Talk to you later. All right. And we are joined by second time guest on the podcast, Marissa Carter, who some people may remember from the UNE podcast that we did a while back about the exhibitions here on campus. And what caused you to take the field school, Marissa?
I decided late in my college career that I really, really liked anthropology and archaeology and really needed to do it in the field before I left.
Excellent.
So it's the perfect opportunity. Did the historic field school or field class and then decided to do prehistoric field school for extra experience before I figure out what the heck to do next.
Excellent, because your major interest is GIS originally, right?
Yeah, so started in marine bio, realized I really liked GIS, and then realized that I could use GIS with archaeology, and so kind of how I got into doing some research with it too.
Fantastic, and what was your favorite part about field school this year?
Just like being in the pit and just finding and discovering things is the best feeling, where it's like traveling up and discovering a giant flake that you didn't think was there.
Fantastic.
So fun.
All right. Thank you, Marissa.
Yeah.
All right. I am sitting at the lovely University of New England site, and I am joined by Taylor McCoy of the University of New Brunswick. How are you, Taylor?
I'm great. Thanks for asking. How are you?
Very well, thanks. What led you to take the field school this year?
I'm interested in getting into archaeology, so I figured it was good to get some field experience, and I know it's good to have for your future career, and
excellent.
Just being able to apply everything I've learned in the field.
Great. So what year are you at UNB?
I just finished my second year.
Excellent. So you've taken some anthropology classes
there.
I have,
yeah.
Fantastic. What's been the highlight of the field school for you?
I have to say, finding the first flake out at Kennebunk.
Uh-huh.
I mean, for my first archaeological find, but also the first find at the site, which kind of made it a site for us.
Yes.
And then it like kicks in that you're the first person to touch that in thousands of years, which is pretty cool.
Very cool. Yeah, excellent. And the listener can't tell this, but Taylor has also been the first student we've ever had who's managed to maintain perfectly painted nails for the entire field school. And so if anyone wants advice on doing that, they can reach out to you.
Perfect.
That's excellent. Okay, what are your plans for the upcoming semester and continuing in archaeology?
I'm going to take some more anthropology courses, do an arts internship, hopefully work with the Bailey Collection. Probably do the honors course next year. Just trying to get, probably ESAF as well.
Oh, excellent.
Do a poster about the Kennebunk site.
Excellent. Hopefully. Yeah, so that's something the listener can look forward to. Is we think we're going to have the students do a poster about the Kennebunk site.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Taylor.
Yeah, no problem.
All right. I am back with Arthur Anderson. We have left Kennebunk Plains, but I thought maybe you'd like to summarize what we ended up finding. I'll give a sneak preview. It is not a site we would call heading to. Or, you know, Vale 3, Fulbrook 4.
Yeah, I'm not about to use the term fluted.
No.
We found a lithic scatter that seems to be archaic.
Uh-huh.
Not a lot of stratigraphy.
More fluted than Jethro Tull?
Some rhyolite flakes.
Oh, you mean not Paleo-Indian?
Not Paleo-Indian.
Oh, fascinating.
As far as we can tell.
Right. How many hundreds of flakes did we find?
0.100.
Oh.
Yep.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So not what we're looking for, but science marches forward.
Science marches forward.
That's
and
important thing. And students keep learning, which is the other important thing. So
right.
As we shift to a more phase 3 type research excavation, they've cut their teeth on a little bit of a phase 1. We're doing it in order for once, and that'll be good.
So we have totally mitigated that lithic scatter, I would say, right?
I think we have.
Yes, I think it's fully mitigated. And we've each ordered a book by Christina Reith about small lithic scatters.
Yep.
Yes. The book about big lithic scatters was not helpful to us.
No, we don't need that volume.
Yes, that's right. And so what are we doing now?
Now we are over on the UNE campus at a site here on the coast in the mouth of the Saco River that we've worked at before. Some of you may have heard or read about, but This spot was a late woodland village visited by Champlain in the summer of 1605. But in our archaeological excavations and archaeological excavations before us, it seems there's about 4,000 years of occupation kind of on this landform by the mouth of the river that we've been learning more about and disentangling while training students for maybe 7 years now.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. And we are about...
they're having fun.
Yeah, they are having fun. You can tell. But yeah, that's interesting. That's not the sound of work. That's fascinating. I don't know about you, Arthur, but I think I just heard C minus echoing over the horizon there. But am I right that we should be about to get into archaeology? Because we are we've just about scraped off the layers of sand that get blown in on top of the site.
Yeah, we've got things cleaned up, and there's some complex coastal processes on this site. But there does seem to be a cap of windblown or recent storm deposited sand and trash on top of the archaeological levels, which we've dug through. So we're cleaning off what seems to be the top of the stratigraphy in which we find archaeology. We got just a couple of flakes coming up so far. So now we're ready to kind of change gears and get right into some archaeological stratigraphy, which I think the students are pretty excited about after not finding Hedden 2.
Absolutely. Fantastic. Well, thanks, Arthur. And we'll catch up with you shortly.
Thanks, Gabe.
Thank you. All right. Well, I'm joined by Trevor Dow, and he's a frequent guest, roving correspondent, really, on the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast. And how are you, Trevor?
Doing well, Gabe. I'm doing well.
Excellent. And the reason we have Trevor on today is because we're talking about the UNE Archaeological Field School that ECOFOR was the community partner for. And so, as you know, the listener will know, ECOFOR is the company that Trevor works for. Could you tell us a little bit about ECOFOR, Trevor?
ECOFOR is a multi-services, natural resources, culture resource management company. We do...
And swag.
And swag, yeah, and a advertised swag company. But we do biological field work, environmental studies, forestry work, archaeology and heritage, obviously, and all sorts of things in that sort of land use planning kind of an environmental assessment realm, really.
Excellent. And we were fortunate this season, as I mentioned, to have ECOFOR as the community partner with the field school. And so, Trevor, could you just kind of explain how the community partner thing works?
Yeah, so it's, I think, a great program through the University of New Brunswick's experiential learning group, where, educational opportunities that are, hands-on and practical, like an archaeology field school, work with community partners, people who are, working professionals in the same sort of field, to sort of work together and collaborate on these training and education initiatives. So for this year's field school, ECOFOR was a community partner, and we gave my time to the field school for a couple of weeks to do some work in the field and do some training and just talk about CRM and sort of careers for students in the future if they choose to go that kind of route. But
terrific.
I think it's a fantastic sort of program because it helps link students with professionals in the fields that they're hoping to pursue a career in, right? So I think it's a win-win for everyone. But.
Yeah, I agree. And so it worked out really well, I thought. I mean, a highlight for me was it was nice having kind of basically three instructors out there. And if you imagine sort of the baseball game box in which you've got three instructors from all sorts of different experiences, so you can get the CRM perspective alongside the kind of academic perspective on the work. So that was a real highlight. I'm hoping we can actually continue to expand this in the future with the field school.
Yeah, me too. And I think ECOFOR would be keen on doing something like that. They're really keen on initiatives like this for training and things like that. But they're also quite keen on doing things that sort of are community projects, if you will, like kind of ways for us to kind of give back to the community. But I had a really great time. I had a good time in the field, teaching field techniques and stuff like that. I think the best part for me was actually before I got in the field, and you guys were out there for a week before I was able to get out there and join you, and I got an email from one of the students who I had taught this past winter in an archaeology class, and she was like, "I identified my first flake today thanks to the techniques I learned in your lab." And I was like, "Awesome." Like, you know, it's that's just fantastic. That's a great kind of email to get from somebody and to kind of hear that kind of stuff. But also just to see how much enjoyment the students were getting out of it. You could tell that they were having a good time kind of actually doing this thing that we talk about all the time in class, right? So,
absolutely. Yeah. And that's, I guess, one of the exciting things about field school. Well, thanks very much, Trevor. And thanks, Ecofor, for sponsoring the field school. And we look forward to, I think, the end of Casablanca. This could be the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Fantastic. All right. Well, thanks very much, Trevor.
So we're at UNB Archives and Special Collections. We didn't get any field recording because I forgot to, and it was sort of busy. Here with Dallas Toma. He's running the camera.
Appreciate it.
So what were we doing this week?
So this week we were doing some surface surveys at Fulton Island, and we had a couple of site visits from community members as well as local professionals. We found a couple of distant surface surveys, and we found some flakes as well as some bifaces on the eroding shore at Fulton Island. And we also took an opportunity to sort of lay out some excavations and some test pits on the island as well.
Is this your first experience with, like, formal archaeological work?
I actually had the opportunity to work with Dr. Holyoke on a previous excavation out near Belle Isle Bay at a quarry site that had large deposits of washed amok chert on it, which was a cool experience as well.
And so, Dal, you've been on here before. We spoke back at the CCRA conference, and so you've done some CRM work, and you're an undergrad here at UNB, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You're going into your last year, and what sort of work are you thinking about is going to be that this sort of work is going to help with what you're thinking about for what you want to do with your soon-to-be anthropology degree?
Archaeology creates a really interesting opportunity for offering sort of community engagement and sort of reconnecting the ancestral peoples, the people that are sort of connected to not only sort of the materials that archaeologists often engage with, but also the landscapes that these sort of cultural materials come from, and sort of really reconnects that sort of cultural base from sort of like the physical, pieces merely being sort of material pieces. You know, it really sort of intertwines that cultural narrative that I think is really important to understanding what these materials are and what they represent for people in the present, not only trying to get an understanding of people in the past.
Well, thank you for, we had a good week out there, and I think you and I are going to do a little bit of Saturday field work tomorrow.
Yeah.
Get the profiles and things like that drawn up. So maybe we'll bring the microphone out in the field and hope we don't get dirt in my computer.
Yeah. Bring another hard drive for you.
Yeah, exactly. So Kira, before you go.
Yes.
How was your first week of field archaeology?
Oh my gosh, it was probably one of the best experiences I've ever had. I like learned so many new things and really stepped out of my comfort zone with a lot, especially the bugs. Like
yes, the listener will not know that Kira not only hadn't done archaeology before, but was not comfortable with bugs or anything. And you weathered like an incredibly mosquito-laden day.
Yeah. Yeah. I just became one like you told me to with the bugs.
You got at peace with the bugs out there.
Yes,
I did. So now you're going to be like, you're just going to set up your tent now and just go camping every weekend? Is that the idea?
We'll see. Maybe I might actually get a cabin. Who knows? That'd
okay.
be fun.
Very nice. Well, it was excellent having you out there. And yes, we'll see what's in store for next week. We're joined by Ramona Nicholas, who's a Wolastoqwig archaeologist, and joined me, co-director of the Lower Wolastoq Archaeology Project, or Erosion Project, this summer. And so, Ramona, you have worked in archaeology now for over 30 years.
Around there.
And so...
I won't say over, because, you know, it hasn't been quite 30 years.
That's true. I guess, yeah, that's true. It hasn't been, has it?
No.
Is next year 30 years?
Yes.
From Gemsay?
Yes.
Crazy.
Yep.
Well, so Ramona, so Gemsig, was this that was where you cut your teeth doing some archaeology work?
Yes, it was.
And so what was your role at Gemsig? Was it you're a community member from Tobik and you were involved right from the get-go, or did you just hear about it and always had an interest in archaeology?
So I had always had like a bit of an interest in archaeology. There was an opportunity that came up. I was approached by Karen Furley at the time, who had kind of been there since the beginning. They had a really small crew, and she asked me if I was interested in becoming a part of the project. And at the time, it seemed like a really interesting thing to do, and having the opportunity to actually go out and do field work. I just wanted to learn, and so I jumped in and started doing the work.
And you were there for basically the whole thing, all through the winter and right up into the spring when things like wrapped up, basically.
Yeah. So when I started, I was in the field, you know, doing the digging and all of that. And then at one point, we realized that we were going to have much, much larger crew. And so they asked me if I wanted to just stay in the lab and kind of supervise and do all of that. And so it was a good opportunity. So I took it.
I will remember we had Susan Blair on in our first season talking about Gemsig, and there's a great picture of you kind of running the lab. So they had an on-site lab, basically. And so yes, you were running the on-site lab and kind of keeping an eye on things. But so Gemsig wasn't your only experience in archaeology. You've continued to do archaeology, and you've gone on to do your master's at UNB. And some of the work that you've been doing is you've done some CRM work as well. But tell us a little bit about what your thesis work was, because the methodologies that you used and talked about in your thesis are ones that we're trying to bring into some of the work that we're doing now.
Yeah. So the idea was just to, and it's kind of the title of my thesis was just, you know, kind of giving voice to the ancestors. So it's really like a different kind of perspective of how we look at like the past, but including like the traditional knowledge that we know today and carrying through all of that. And so just like taking the information, like I said, and just putting into the perspective of how our ancestors, how we would have envisioned our ancestors living thousands of years ago. And a lot of that is through like knowing ceremonial things, like, you know, knowing the traditional knowledge things of like basket making, and but also like plant knowledge and yeah.
So sort of practice and sort of kind of Western approaches to archaeology and in what's Bartlett and Marshall have called two-eyed seeing, basically, is the approach. So you've done archaeology and you've done some CRM work. You've done some curatorial work as well.
Yes. Yeah. So I am a volunteer curator with the Fredericton Region Museum. The exhibit that I curate is called the Wabanaki Way. And it started as a invitation from David Black to like redo the room that they had there before. It was called the Maliseet Room. And so they wanted to give it an update. And so I worked with some community members. I invited elders into the room. And there was a point too where APANB.
Yep.
I invited people to come take a look at some of those artifacts so that we can give them a little bit more complete information.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. The famous Kingsclear Point as well. Yeah. So, okay. So this week we were out in the field and we did a bunch of stuff. What was the highlight of the week from your perspective?
For me, it was sitting on that bank and finding all those flakes and then looking over and seeing something white underneath that tree and kind of pulling it out. And two, just bringing others out into the field and showing them what, like, you know, what it is to do this work and to, you know, when you first start recognizing, you know, those bits and pieces that are out there and then seeing everybody else do that and, you know, just that look of like pride and joy on people's faces to see, you know, the stuff that we're finding, but also the work that they're doing.
Yeah, considerable kind of educational piece to this work. And so the crew folks that you'll hear were all out there sort of learning, cutting their teeth in archaeology, and a little bit probably slower than your introduction to archaeology. Probably you had to hit the ground running a little bit more at Gemsig.
And that was the thing, because it was such a small crew at the beginning, but then discovering how large the site really, really was.
Yeah.
And having to bring in a whole bunch of people to do the work and manage all of that. So yeah, it was really, yeah.
Well,
hit the ground running.
Willie and Ramona, it's been a really fun week, and next week will be also fun.
Yeah. It sure will be. I didn't want to leave today.
Who's been roped into another project of ours, the Bailey Project. So Becca Ireland, so can you tell us what your background is and what you're doing? And
I feel like I have a background of kind of a little bit of everything, because it's that holistic viewpoint that I have that everything is connected. So I've been in education for a while, kind of got into science at some point, and then got a Bachelor of Science in Environmental Management, did four school practitioner course. I'm also a certified Indigenous full-spectrum doula, and I took the Wolastoqe language program offered through STU at St. Mary's. And now I'm working on a master's in education focused on land-based education with Wolastoqe language revival.
This was your first, delving into archaeology as part of that holistic exposure, right? That educational experience.
I've been in holes before, like for environmental management, like digging holes, but this is the first time looking for artifacts and finding stuff. It's pretty cool.
So apart from saving us all from getting terrible poison ivy for the entire week, what was your best experience out of this week, and what are you taking with you apart from just like kind of new exposure to sort of a new set of techniques?
My favorite part is actually just being in the field with my daughter, and as these artifacts are coming out of the ground, Wolastoqe, Lodwe, Wagon just keeps coming out. Like, we're kind of trying to re-expose the language to these artifacts again. And I feel like it's also bringing that out in us, that like that's what it wants to hear. And yeah, it's just a really good energy. I will say the energy has definitely changed since we've been in the room. And Ram and I were just talking about it, and I said, well, look at these pieces, like where they're at. They're in a box, they're wrapped in plastic. Like, these are pH neutral boxes. Like, is this really where you want to be? You know, and we're all kind of like, we want to stay out in the woods. Like, that's where those artifacts, like that energy was like so great, because you're just outside and with that natural frequency and just that natural vibe where it feels good.
Okay. So the collections work is not really where you're drawing a positive energy. The listener can't see this, but the thumb is turning towards a down point. So you're a language speaker. You're learning language. Where would you put yourself on that?
I call myself a language warrior. I have a hard time like speaking fluently. I can understand quite a bit, but I like to say that I'm a language warrior because I want to make sure that our language perseveres and that it's still there for those next seven generations, because it's really important. And I feel like a lot of what we want to know about who we are as Wolastoqe'ik is within the language, especially that archaic style language.
Yeah. And you had a word for what we were doing this week when we were packing up today. Would you be willing to share that?
I have to look at it again. It's not always easy to pull things from my brain. Nuolunke Oltiben. Nuolunke Zoltiben. Pabachiman Aurora. Ask Aurora. She's really good with her pronunciation and like reading. For me, reading it is a little bit more difficult because I'm pretty sure I'm dyslexic. So that, like, I have to have it pronounced for me a couple of times to really understand or to really get that pronunciation. But
what's the meaning behind that?
So actually it was Dallas who was like, we need a team lead, a name, like we need a team name. And he wanted us just to like that reminder that to take care of each other, like we take care of each other. And that's what we did this past week. And that's what we're going to continue to do, is to look out for each other, making sure we're being hydrated, fed, you know, doing the right things and having the right stuff. And yeah, it's just that we're going to look out for each other.
From XYZ coordinates to ensuring that we don't have poison ivy and we're not putting poison ivy on all of our equipment.
Yeah. You were pretty good, though, at putting your equipment right into the poison ivy. Like, every time.
I was also very good at losing my equipment, which I'm very good at all the time. And Becca was very good at pointing out where I had lost my equipment the most recently. That was a big help as well.
Yeah.
You were always looking out for me, which I appreciate.
I'm just always on the watch, I guess.
Thank you, Becca.
Well, Ken, I think it's time for Hit Pieces.
I think it is time for Hit Pieces.
And we're headed back to the world of the sea mink.
The world, yeah. Are we back to the world of the sea?
Well, I guess we've discussed extinct animals somewhat on this. You
know, yes,
we've did some great auk, and I think we had a little tangential discussion about sea mink.
Well, and we were talking about extinct animals a couple weeks ago, and then Patrick wrote in about extinct animals.
That's right.
A long time ago.
That's right.
Yeah.
This is Holocene overkill that we're talking about now, though.
Yeah. Late Holocene, early Anthropocene, really.
Yes.
Overkill.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, listener, what Ken and I are going to do here is we're going to share with you a paper that actually is technical enough to be a bit beyond our understanding.
Yes.
But the gist of this is that because shell heaps preserve fauna that would not otherwise be preserved, they're not just useful for archaeologists, they're useful for people doing environmental research about past animals, because you have preserved past animals in shell heaps. And there's been a kind of longstanding debate about whether the sea mink is distinct from the other kind of mink, the kind of mink we still have.
Yes. Yeah. And so, and I think that the sea mink is generally larger. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. And so, but feel free, listener, to write in if Ken and I have screwed this up badly.
Yeah, you know when it's an article in Quaternary Research, it's going to take at least two or three reads to get.
I think that's true. And so, you know, but lots of people we know and admire have written about this. So like Dave Black and Art Spies have both done a lot of work on sea mink. Folks at UMaine have done work on sea mink. I think Bonnie Newsom's recently done some work on sea mink, or at least her lab group has, I think.
Is sea mink the one that they realized there's that paper where they realized that like one side of the skull was not being preserved, or is that?
There is a sea mink connection at Machias. That's seals you're thinking about.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But there is sea mink to do with Machias.
Okay,
And so maybe what we'll do now, listener, is we'll introduce the paper. And while you're distracted looking it up, Ken and I will continue to pontificate. So, Ken, what is the paper?
So it's a multidisciplinary approach to resolve the taxonomy of the historically extinct sea mink, Neogale, Macrodon, Maine, USA. This is in Quaternary Research. Just came out. It is, where's the issue information here? Oh, it's in First View still. It actually doesn't have an issue number.
That's how current this podcast is.
That's how current this podcast is. And so the lead author is Paula Work, who is one of the archaeologists at the Maine State Museum. She's a geologist, isn't she?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Robert Lewis, Beverly Johnson, and Bruce Bork. And so I don't know the affiliation. Oh, they're all so Paula
Maine
Work.
Maine State Museum and Bates College, right?
In Bates College, yeah. Beverly Johnson's at the Bates College, and Bruce Bork is at the Maine State Museum and has an affiliation with Bates College. So. Yeah.
Former colleague of mine at Bates.
Yes. Yeah. So the findings basically, the gist of it is that they studied a bunch, like over 1,200 individual specimens of sea mink from archaeological contexts and essentially argue that it was indeed a distinct species from the American, I think it's American mink, is that what it is?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. It does appear that there were two species that were sought after in the archaeological record.
Excellent.
And then there's some other implications, I think, that I didn't get that far with the my understanding.
My understanding is that the archaeological findings here are virtually consistent with the rest of the current literature.
Yes. Yeah. It's a similar approach to, I think, the fish project. That Thomas is working on.
Where Thomas they're, Royal.
Yeah. Yep. And they're using archaeological fish species to build on kind of current research in biology, basically.
Yes. Yeah. And it's also kind of the theme. I think this was when we were talking about climate change with Matt Betts, but also with your colleague in Alberta.
Oh, Robin Wiebutka.
Yes. Yeah. I wanted you to say that name, and I was. they both mentioned that the archaeological record and the environmental record share a repository.
Yes.
And that this is firmly within that.
And you know what, Gabe?
Yes.
This is another human-environmental interaction.
This really is, yes. Yeah. We've really hit those hard this human-environmental interaction season.
Yes, yeah. We successfully, I think, weaved it into various different elements of the... Yeah. As promised. I mean, actually, this is probably the season finale for season 3.
I think it probably should be.
It's episode 21, so if we're like a 90s sitcom...
It's actually episode 20.
I think we're at the. I think that's the limit.
Oh, is it? Okay, this is good to know.
Yeah.
Are we ready to announce yet what the next theme is?
Well, we had a session where we spitballed this and we were going to reach out to a bunch of people, and I don't think either of us have done our homework on that. So
I think it'd be beyond
disappointing to reveal what that is. But we have some exciting
ideas.
Beyond
Disappointing is actually the name of the next season. But yeah, I think we're going to start season 4.
Yeah. So I think this is probably a good place to, end the field season can be kind of the ceremonial end of the previous season.
That's a great idea. And plus it kind of works because we're in studio.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah. Maybe we can try to finish, do a studio recording at the end of each season.
That's a great idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not to be confused with our live albums.
Yeah. Yes. And I guess I wasn't looking at you directly during the rest of the show, but I'm just realizing the hot peppers on your t-shirt. It's like the listener doesn't see the videos of these podcasts, but usually I'm the one with the fun guy shirt?
Our friend Evan calls these fun guy shirts.
Fun guy shirts, yes.
And Ken usually wears them and I usually don't. And I actually put this on today because I thought Ken would be wearing one.
Yeah.
And I thought that would be funny. Instead, Ken is wearing what appears to be head-to-toe olive drab.
Yeah.
He sort of looks like an army captain on vacation.
Yeah, or like a 50-year-old dad who got all his clothes at Costco. What this is a testament to is I haven't been able to do laundry for about a week or so, and so it's now time to do that.
And the great thing, listener, about the clothes Ken's wearing is when he says do laundry, he means just wash it because it looks like they all dry instantly. Like he actually walked in here and I got a nosebleed. That was how dry the air became. Sucked the moisture out of the room.
I'm just preparing to go back to the dry heat of the Canadian prairies.
Yes. Well, listener, on that note, or Ken, on that note about technical fabric, should we perhaps bring season 21 to a close?
Episode 21 of season 3.
Sorry, it's actually a little disorienting, listener, being in the studio here because ordinarily I have a bunch of stuff spread out in front of me, but instead I've just been staring straight at Ken the whole season.
It is different that way, and it's funny because I don't think. You don't usually have a conversation looking right at somebody like this either. So I think next time we're in the studio, I think we need to have a beverage just in the table between us.
Yeah, they were very clear that a half-finished glass of Courvoisier was not allowed in the studio.
Yeah, unfortunately.
And we, of course, are careful about following those rules. But I think we could perhaps get a Courvoisier exemption.
Yeah, one would hope. And who knows? Maybe we'll come back in season 4 with Courvoisier and Balvenie and Moosehead all throwing in their chips on us.
I hope so, yes. If frankly, honestly, listener, even if you're just a fairly successful home brewer who would like the listeners to know more about your product, we
do have some
for
friends
a modest
who,
price.
We do have some friends that make some very good homebrew. We should try to see if we can get an exclusive NB ArcPod brew.
We do. And listener, you'll notice Ken said we have some friends that make some very good homebrew. That leaves room for our friends who make some not very good homebrew.
Yeah. All right, listener.
Well, listener, it's been fun. We're looking forward to seeing you, talking to you again soon.
Yeah, yeah. This has been great. We celebrated our 50th episode and had a lot of fun and covered a lot of ground this summer, this season. So looking forward to when we pick this up again. Like I said, could be 2 weeks, could be three. It could be August. kind of depends how the next few weeks go.
But, so subscribe now so you'll find out when we're back.
Exactly. And there's a back catalog always waiting for you. And we are working on some stuff to try to get a little bit more navigating that back catalog in an easier way and to walk you through New Brunswick archaeology. And I will say it has been a thrill meeting people in the wild who are fans.
Yes.
Was at Culber Consulting today, met her crew, and one of the women – when Chelsea introduced me, she said, "Oh, from the podcast."
And oh, that's lovely.
which is pretty neat.
Fantastic.
So, so to friends and cousins and people that I grew up with who have said over the last few weeks that they listen to the podcast, really appreciate your support. To anybody who has never written in but enjoys the show, thank you. And for those of you that take the time to send an email, it's always fun to read that and have no problem coming up and saying that you want a sticker. So we're always happy to provide.
And we haven't really made this well known, but honestly, you can just email us your address and we'll probably send you a sticker.
Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah.
And we won't read your address on there.
Yeah. We won't dox you. And you don't even send just no subject, like my students do. Just send me an email that has, "Hey, I want some stickers."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Precisely. So, yeah. But then you need to add an address.
Yes.
All right, listener. Well, we will talk to you soon.
Yeah. Talk to you soon, listener.